are undocumented in the state, and that makes a huge difference. Let's keep making huge differences all over Oregon. I want to thank you all for tuning in and listening to KBOO. I want to thank John Shuck for being our engineer and forwarding your voices to us and getting that music for us. And just thanks to all KBOO listeners for being the listeners who care about the issues that we care to bring you. Thank you again.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
KBOO, Portland, it's 9 o'clock, and Press Watch is coming up next. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Between the Covers. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake shares her singular takes on politics, parenting, and pop culture with your host, S.W. Konser. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium on Saturday, October 26th from noon to 6 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center in Portland. The Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium will feature artist talks and presentations by Native artists, a panel discussion, a community meal, an artist marketplace, and more. Again, that's the Native Artist and Storyteller Symposium on Saturday, October 26th from noon to 6 p.m. at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center, 710 Southwest Jackson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your free People's Radio Station. KBOO Portland, and I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly, media manipulation, and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. This morning, I hope to be joined at the bottom of the hour by Arun Gupta, and we will talk impeachment and other affairs, and today I want to talk about what's going on in Chile. I've noticed that there isn't a lot of coverage of what's going on in Chile. And I think that's pretty much what I expected from the corporate-owned media. It's I noticed that, for example, the Guardian and the Google News role and the U.S. press has rather minimal mention of it. But Chile is having a tremendous social upheaval right now. And it's very significant because the U.S. has always been meddling in Chile out of imperialism, of course, but also out of a sort of cruel desire to experiment. And one aspect of that has been the imposition of the neoliberal economic agenda under the Chicago School, and that started back in 1973 when Henry Kissinger and others were successful in imposing a dictatorship on Chile. And that regime, the Pinochet, is out of the picture and gone now. But that attempt is still very much going forward, and I have suspected, as the neocons, here in the U.S. we call them neocons, around the world they're called neoliberals, as the those who would crush the working class, let me put it that way, have come to power even more than usual in the U.S., even more openly, under the Trump administration. It doesn't really surprise me that the reaction to popular dissent against the crushing economic conditions in Chile has been brutally suppressed. First let me give you some information from Radio Havana, Cuba, reporting from Santiago de Chile. You'll sometimes see Santiago put down as Santiago de Chile because two of the great Santiagos in the world are one in Cuba and one in Chile. And I've been to the one in Cuba. Haven't been to Chile. Would like to see what's going on now, but Radio Havana reports workers, organizations, and political and trade union movements will develop today, the second day of a general strike called by the Unitary Central of Workers, the CUT of Chile, against the economic measures of the government and demand the resignation of the ruler, Sebastián Piñera. Now, what I have here is a clumsy machine translation, so I'll try to work out the kinks as I go along. They write, the conglomerate of organizations grouped in the social unit table, constituted by more than 50 movements, urged the Chileans to a two-day national strike that culminates this Thursday in rejection of Piñera's management. Demonstrators, during the day of peaceful protests in the evening, demanded the immediate resignation of Piñera, who had declared the South American country in a state of emergency. And that declaration deepened a social and governance crisis unprecedented in the history of the nation. We all have to stand firm because there has to be a change. That's a quote some of the protesters made on Twitter. In it's all Chile, it's a whole country. So these demonstrations are going on in several cities, not just Santiago. The organizers of the national strike, write Havana, said today that the forces will focus on the demonstrations at the territorial level, while they called to mobilize in all corners of our country. Under the slogan, "We are tired and we are united," Chileans demanded the immediate repeal of the state of emergency and the return of the military to their units and barracks. Now, speaking for myself, they are tired of corruption, and they're literally tired because, like U.S. citizens, like the youth in the United States, when I say youth, I'm talking about 20-somethings and 30-somethings as well, they are overworked, severely, grotesquely overworked and underpaid. They're lucky to get in $400 a month. And they had an increase in the... they very much, because of real estate speculation, sound familiar, they, by and large, the working class has to travel quite a distance on the metro. And the metro in Chile is part of the Chicago economics pride, even though it was actually started well before them and was built up by Allende, that word that you're not supposed to say in Chile. And but it's a very nice metro, it's a very nice subway, but now they have to pay something like an eighth of their monthly income just to get to work. And when you're making $400 a month, you can't pay an eighth of your monthly income, you can't do it. So there was a movement to jump the turnstiles, and that was something that was, I would say, you know, it's easy to have hindsight 2020, but I would say if that had been tolerated, it might have led to a better subsidy of the fares. Although, you know, they hate that with the Chicago economic model. It's all harshness and shock doctrine and that sort of thing under the Chicago boys. Would have been a fight, but the president, pardon me, decided to viciously, cruelly repress the movement to jump the turnstiles, and so people were beaten and beaten and beaten and carried off and frightened. And of course, all of this takes place in the context of the murderous disappearances of the Pinochet-Nixon-Kissinger horror of 1973, the September 11th horror. More on that in a minute. But returning to the text, they asked the parliamentarians, the protesters asked the parliamentarians of the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies to carry out a legislative strike. And consequently, no bill is being processed, and there's no ratification of international treaties. The strikers also proposed to establish a national constituent assembly to develop in a participatory way a new structural framework of Chilean society and thereby open the way to a national development model which ends the current unfair and abusive neoliberal model. The National Institute of Human Rights alerted the government about violations of citizenship during the days of protests, which led to the deaths of 18 people, is 18 dead already that we know of, and hundreds of injured at the hands of state forces. The representatives of the Social Unity Table urged the population to reject the general strike, to reject during the general strike the declarations of the Pinera regime, where he assured that the nation is at war. The trade unionists are quoted saying, "Whoever drags a serious confrontation into the country does not deserve to be president of Chile, so we demand his resignation." Pardon these little delays. I'm probably the least prepared for a show that I have been in a long time. I had a little bit of a health problem. I seem to be better now. And trying to put it together at the last minute. I also have some audio. Let me see if I can find it. Maybe not. The audio that I got from Twitter was pretty shocking, because it was a sound of the demonstration from several stories above, and it's just a sound of a gigantic demonstration. Looks like I'm not going to get that quite as easily as I had hoped. So again, please bear with me. Information was from Radio Havana, Cuba, and they were one of the few organizations that were actually on the streets and reporting. There's also information from Jacobin. Rene Rojas is writing in Jacobin, and he is writing more generally, framing the situation there. 2 years ago, nationwide elections began reshaping Chile's oligarchic party system, but the pace of change was too slow to prevent festering discontent and outrage against the political class from boiling over onto the streets. The last few days of spontaneous and uncontainable protest, looting, and arson will leave in ruins a regime that is, in the eyes of the working and poor masses, has long worn out its welcome. This is just the beginning, they tell us, and as the fires spread and burn, Chile will be transformed irreversibly. But when the smoke clears, what will the new Chile look like? He writes, the immediate trigger for the uprising was the executive's October 1st announcement that peak subway fares would increase by 30 pesos. Considering the 800 pesos rate, $1.15, was already the second highest subway fare in Latin America, and neither the panel of experts that recommended it, the right-wing Sebastián Piñera administration, nor its mainstream opposition, anticipated any pushback against the hike. But continuing an upsurge in student protests that has lasted since 2006, youth responded with mass civil disobedience. High school federations mobilized a social media coordinated campaign of turnstile jumping through the capital. After a week of direct action by students, the campaign grew until, by the week of October 14th, it had spread through the city. The public-private consortium that manages Santiago's dysfunctional transit system estimated losses of nearly $250,000. In response, Piñera opted for a heavy-handed law and order approach. When students, now with the support of local community activists, intensified and expanded their protests to numerous subway stations last Friday, the government called special Carabinero shock forces to stop the teenagers, often trapping and beating them in cars. The reaction was immediate. What had been mild disturbances accompanying the collective fare evasions morphed into widespread vandalism and destruction. Punitively and idiotically, at 4 p.m. right before rush hour, Piñera shut down the entire transit system. Stranded in a city where public transit commutes easily exceed 2 hours, and learning of the crackdown against their children, exhausted and desperate people erupted with a fury uncharacteristic of Chile's marginalized sectors, generally considered more restrained than their regional counterparts. The hike and slaps in the face that followed were the final straw after decades of growing inequality, apartheid-like public services, and oligarchic rule. Now, speaking for myself, aside from the fact that this is the news you're not supposed to know, and aside from the fact that I just want to report things that are not reported, I think this is quite relevant because, as I was saying, this pressure on the working class, this cruelty in terms of overworking the young, and again, I'm 61, so I'm defining the young as people 30 years younger than me. It's out of control, and it has to bring results. And right now, in the United States, we have this electoral hope, and we have three quarters of the squad endorsing Sanders' economic model, and we have Warren, starting to bend to the left. And so there's this hope that electorally things can be moved forward so that we're not, you know, just crushing the blood out of the working class, even though, and I phrase it that way, even though the people who are most affected by all this would fiercely resist being called the working class. Folks, if you depend on a paycheck, you're working class. But I've just been informed by the ever helpful engineer that we may have audio from that that Twitter feed. Do you want to play some of that? That the video for that shows a very large boulevard, downtown boulevard, absolutely crammed with people. Yeah. Gee, it sounds like Portland. Times 10. Okay, thanks for that. Just wanted to get some of that audio across and had clicked off my tab and was trying to refine that. So thanks so much, Ray. I appreciate that. So I would like to invite your calls and comments. The Occupy motion, the movement in the United States, burst forth in 2011, and it, as much as it was hooted at for not having a focus, it actually did have a focus, which was maldistribution of wealth in the United States, and it cracked open the door to class consciousness in the United States. Since then, the powers that be, the those who would define you as consumers instead of as citizens, the rich, have tried to make you forget it and tried to substitute various baubles and various distractions for the fact that you really need to fight for your rights. And also, the Occupy movement itself was very heavily infiltrated. We have this in great detail now. Naomi Klein, for example, speaks to that in some detail. It was brought down by the state very consciously. Compared to what they have to spend in terms of tanks and bombs for other nations that rise up and demand their rights, it was pretty cheap, but they did it. So Occupy didn't just fizzle, it was beaten down. And there's a connection here with Occupy and with what's going on in Chile as well, because a lot of their attempts at reforms originated in 2011 and were part of that global energy. So, as I was saying, you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. It's 17 minutes after the top of the hour. Now, at the bottom of the hour, if luck is with me, then we'll be joined by a journalist, writer, international journalist, Arun Gupta, who I'm hoping will be coming into the studios. And until then and after then, you can call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. 8187. I've been focusing on Chile, and part of my focus is the fact that Chile right now is a mirror, a distant mirror of what's happening or what can happen in the United States. I just took, as I was mentioning last week, I just took a transcontinental trip, and one of the things I noticed is that there was a bit of foolishness in taking a transcontinental trip in a car festooned with defiant bumper stickers. I was stopped twice by cops before I got smart and removed those bumper stickers. Not that I don't believe in them or believe that it's, you know, worth being defiant, etc., but I just wanted to get across the damn country. And the car was 20 years old, and I noticed that that also made it stand out. And I had to wonder how, I mean, I know that people are hurting for money, so how in the world did they get the money? Did everyone get the money for a much newer car? And actually, I've discovered the answer. And this is another thing that has not been reported on very much in the United States. We now have subprime auto lending. And like the subprime bubble that brought down the financial institutions in 07 and 08, the subprime bubble for auto lending is going to do the same thing. It's one of the reasons that there is going to be another and worse crash. People found this new loophole. By people, I mean billionaires, Wall Street speculators, gamblers, in collaboration with the Obama and now the Trump administration and with Congress, Goldman Sachs types, have found a way to speculate, to profit from speculation on, it's just gambling on whether people will pay the loans. And there's a certain frisson to it. And it's the nature, it's human nature, it's a weird thing, but it's human nature when there's some doubt as to whether you'll be paid back, people just kind of double down and want to go for that bigger reward, even if it puts everything at risk. That's what's going on right now. It has the mixed credit rating tranches. It has all of the characteristics of the absurd and bizarre phenomenon that brought about the 2007-2008 crash. But it's on cars, and so people, instead of being in nice houses that they can't afford, people are driving around cars, and especially pickup trucks, I noticed, going across South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming. Everybody's got a brand new pickup truck, and it's kind of a sad thing because they're going to have to give those back. And they'll be in rather worse condition than some of the housing was, I do believe. So things are weird. Things are strained. Economics are maldistributed. And I think I'm the only person who uses maldistributed. I'm just going to keep using it, though. I think you know what I mean. Distribution of wealth is so grotesque and so extreme. It's worse than it ever was in the 20s. So that we have people who were born to the status of emperors. We have the Walton family, the heirs of the Walmart fortune, who were born with literally tens of billions to their name. Their every whim always served with the utmost deference. Their egos boosted constantly by an army of people who would like to have a taste of that wealth. They don't get to be human. It's kind of sad, really. And then you have billionaires like the Koch brother. One of them's dead. Well, actually, there was more than two, but the two that were famous, one of them's dead now. Who were not only given that treatment, not only given the no one to turn to treatment that Trump was given. Rich people, very rich people, are very sad because they don't know human relations. By and large, they don't get to know their mothers. They get to know a series of nannies, if that. And in the case of that Koch brother, his nanny was literally a Nazi. It's a terrible thing to read about. And that was intentionally so because his dad wanted to create a monster, wanted to create someone whose only sucker in life was the fruits of his extreme greed. And this was developed with the Nazi nurse. I wish I was exaggerating this, but I'm not. So that he is indeed a monster who wishes to crush everyone and believes himself to be a superior, just a wildly superior human being who deserves all the billions and deserves to run the society. And they're getting a good shot at it, I'd say, right now. The resistance is kind of pitiful. But I am encouraging you to be part of that resistance. And part of that is knowing what's going on. Part of that is being part of KBOO. KBOO Radio, Community Radio. Community Radio is radio that is supported by its listeners. That keeps it honest. It's the only way we've been able to keep this sort of programming going for all of these years, for 51 years. The economic model that we have is essential to the way we are. It is what we are. So it's super important that you kick in. If you are not already, then please pull up kboo.fm and kick in. We are, I think, it won't be long now before we get up to speed on podcasting, that sort of thing, but really there's an advantage as well to terrestrial broadcasting, just to tuning it in for free on your car radio or wherever you tune it in. Partly it is that it is out of your hands. It's wonderful to be able to select whatever topic and whatever flavor you like on the internet, on the inner tubes, as I like to joke. But there's also a great advantage to simply listening to a broadcast, not knowing what's coming up, not knowing what's going to be said next, or necessarily who's going to say it. And I noticed that also, crossing the country, I noticed that the Catholic Church obviously also believes in radio, and they're constantly broadcasting according to their model, which is rather different. You know, of course, it's extremely top down, and they're only going to broadcast what they want you to hear. And what I heard town after town when I went across the FM dial was Catholic radio, where there was nothing else. There would be Catholic radio, and they would be, you know, basically putting women in their place and that sort of thing, in the ways that they do their thing, reinforcing Catholicism. It was interesting and a little creepy for me to hear. And they exacerbate and enforce the conservatism, social conservatism, of these lonely towns. Well, let's go to the first caller. The number to call, 503-231-8187, and Sean's on the air.
Good morning, Teresa. Hey, I know you've got a little time before Mr. Gupta shows up. We're coming up on some 30-year anniversaries. In Centralia, Washington, actually, this is a 100-year anniversary. IWW members were martyred. They defended their Union Hall in Centralia, and some American Legionnaires were killed when they attempted to attack the IWW Union Hall. And I was wondering if you had heard anything about any upcoming commemorations or anything by the IWW for their martyred membership 100 years ago up in Centralia?
No, I haven't, but I'll be on the lookout for that. Thanks for bringing it up. I was in Centralia recently. It's a cute little town, and I was conscious of the fact that you know, we have that that legacy there.
I think there's the memorial for the American Legionnaires, but tragically, I'm not sure if there's anything commemorating the IWW men who were killed as a result of defending their Union Hall.
Well, let's bring that up more generally. 100 years ago, there was also this maldistribution of wealth, not as severe as it is now. But it was a different situation because, I'm sorry?
Can you believe that? The Gilded Age and the Roaring Twenties can't hold a candle to the economic inequality and maldistribution that we have now.
Yeah, it's of course, it was technologically a different milieu as well. And
right.
There was both the capacity of living off the land to some extent and the incapacity. I mean, we didn't have modern high-speed AI governed manufacture that
right.
we have. Now,
could I get two more quick things in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, very quickly, coming up on the 30-year anniversary of the liberation psychologist, Ignacio Martin Barros' murder in El Salvador, that's here in November. Then also the 30-year anniversary of the invasion of Panama is December.
You're going to have to say that last part again. It's breaking up. Signal's breaking up.
In Panama, 30 years ago, we're coming up on the 30-year anniversary of the invasion of Panama.
Oh, yes.
I thought I'd just throw that out there and see if you want to riff on it.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for bringing that up. That is one of the things that really got this program to going in KAZI, because I was listening to Radio Havana, who were, as they often are, the only people really reporting on what's going on in Central and South America. And I believe it was November, it was either November or December, it was during a school break, I remember that, the Bush administration initiated this gigantic military buildup on its base in Panama in order to break the treaty and steal back the base and the usage of the, you know, hegemonic usage of the Panama Canal. And they particularly focused when they went to war, when they attacked Panama, on the supporters of Noriega. And Noriega had working-class supporters who were concentrated in a number of apartment buildings, particularly in an area called El Chorrillo. And so in a grotesque spasm of imperial fury, the U.S. forces attacked from their base, using all manner of weapons. They used laser-guided rifles for the first time. They used exploding bullets experimentally. They used they killed indiscriminately. And when you hear that word indiscriminately, I mean they killed everyone, including the kids and the women. And they put bodies on another experimental device. I understand it's a zinc alloy tablet. It's about 2 feet by 3 feet. They would put bodies on this thing and ignite it so that the entire body would shrink. And then they buried them in the Jardín de la Paz. And it was because of Radio Havana's reporting that I was able to identify to the movie The Panama Deception that they would find hundreds of bodies in the Jardín de la Paz. And this is one of the U.S. atrocities that has simply been buried by history. And I'm joined now by Arun Gupta. I'm internationally published journalist, and I have asked Arun to join me to talk about Chile and also talk about impeachment. I'm just so glad that you could make it in. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, great to be with you this morning, Teresa.
We played a little bit of audio from the masses in the streets in Chile, and I was commenting that the coverage here is rather thin. I often use the UK Guardian for its reporting. I've met one of its reporters. They do good reporting on U.S. Cop abuse, for example, but there are things they really don't like to report. And right now, apparently, one of those is Chile, and the torture of Assange seems to be absent from their pages at the moment. So this being the news you're not supposed to know, I'm very glad to have you in here. What have you published lately? You've been, I believe you've been in The Intercept. I know years ago you were in the Guardian as well.
Yeah, I used to write for The Guardian for a while. I've been writing various stuff about the fascists and the Portland mayor and police who give them a lenient hand in this city. Wrote some stuff about climate change, the Julia trial, which is a group of kids who are suing the government.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, saying that climate change is depriving them of their constitutional right to life, liberty, and property, that they're violating their due process rights. I did a piece a couple months ago about the campaign that took down Amazon in New York City. Really quite a remarkable story that, speaking of the media, really few outlets got it right. Guardian was one of them that did get it right. It was basically most of the media. That was for the progressive. Most of the media claimed it was because AOC, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that her tweets took down Amazon, which is an absurd story. But if you look at the coverage, that's what many media outlets pinned it on, that it was because she was tweeting. Whereas what really was going on was just this really intense organizing effort in Queens, a borough that is majority minority. It is majority minority, but it's also majority immigrant. New York City is nearly 40% immigrant, which is something to keep in mind, over 3 million immigrants in the city. And they took down Amazon in large part because of Amazon working to power ICE with facial recognition technology. And so they were able to make that a huge issue. And the campaign was actually led by women of color, immigrants, many of them undocumented, that took down Amazon. And I think it's particularly relevant because, you know, in Seattle, you have Shama Sawant, who is running for re-election, which is in a few weeks, and Amazon is just pouring a massive amount of money to try and defeat her in the city because she had championed a head tax on Amazon employees. You know, Amazon is one of these, you know, it's a $1 trillion company or close to it. That really gouges the taxpayer in all sorts of ways. Its whole business model is actually based on tax theft. Amazon would have never been able to build its business without ripping off cities and states from sales tax. That's how, you know, that's why people were going to Amazon in the early years. It's just like, oh, you didn't have to pay sales tax, so that was an easy way to save 5 to 10% on your book purchases. And so they're pouring in a massive amount of money, something like $1.6 million just in city council races to defeat Shama Sawant and any other left-leaning candidates.
And that's nothing to them, just...
Oh, of course. I mean, Jeff Bezos is, you know, his daily wealth can fluctuate by, you know, it does fluctuate by billions. He's worth something, you know, well north of $100 billion, the richest man in the world.
I'm glad to hear billionaires being discussed nationally because of the, well, I guess because of the Democratic debate with the with the exchange between Sanders and Steyer. But that's the context we find ourselves in. Did you want to talk about impeachment?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is something I think that is really quite fascinating. After Trump was elected, I would have a lot of liberals ask me, you know, when is Trump going to be impeached, you know? And I would try patiently explaining, it's just like impeachment has nothing to do with illegality. Of course, you know, the guy is essentially a third-rate mafioso. Like, you know, if we see his letter to Erdogan, where he's like, you know, don't be a tough guy and, you know, help solve some of your problems, or, you know, what he was saying to the Ukraine president, do us a favor. I mean, he really just sounds like some bad actor trying to act like a mafioso, but that really is his background. You know, he's reportedly been mobbed up from our decades with his dealings with the casinos.
I'm sorry.
And so, you know, I would have people asking me, you know, oh, when's he going to be impeached? You know, it's just like he's done all this illegal stuff. And I'm like, illegality does not matter. Impeachment is a political process. And so finally, we saw something that where he even went too far. And, you know, I just want to quickly say that I've seen just a lot of atrocious left-wing takes on the impeachment process from journalists who I have admired, but I have to wonder what the hell is going on with them. People like Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, Aaron Mate, who's like allegedly a left journalist, was with Democracy Now! And the Real News Network, Doug Henwood. And they have all been anti-impeachment on just the most absurd grounds. Like Matt Taibbi wrote a piece basically calling it a coup. Others, you know, try and say like, oh, this is Russia all over again. Never mind that there was a lot of credible stuff in the Mueller report. And I forget how many Trump associates were convicted in the Russiagate investigation. And clearly, you know, there is something going on between Trump and Russia. Why is he so incredibly deferential? But what we saw with this is that the Democrats had to impeach, right? What Trump was doing was he was trying to rig the election. If they didn't impeach him, there wouldn't really be no election. Not impeaching him would have been saying like, hey, do whatever you want to steal the 2020 election, and it doesn't matter whatever you do then, because the Supreme Court will uphold it, because you have installed a court that is completely unaccountable. I mean, they've just had the most absurd decisions. You know, the one where they, over the summer, approved the funding of the border wall, you know, allowing Trump to move funds from the military. That basically, they threw separation of powers out the window, right? You know, Congress had repeatedly said, no, we are not going to appropriate funds for the wall. We reject this. That is the power of Congress. And then the Supreme Court says, like, oh, you can take the money from wherever you want and fund this absurd border wall, which was just a mnemonic trick, right? That's how it began, that his aides told him early on in his campaign in 2015, talk about the wall to help him remember to talk about immigration, you know, because he has the attention span of a three-year-old.
It's so, a strange thing. I mean, impeachment, I'm a little embarrassed to be so slow sometimes, but when I was traveling across the country, New York and back, I went across that great swath of hegemonically white America. And I mean, all of America is hegemonically white, of course, but it's exaggerated in the middle of the country. And it occurred to me that the rejection of any attack on Trump, and certainly impeachment, is absolute. And it is viewed in terms of white survival. That's how bad the fear is. Attacks on Trump, the impeachment of Trump is viewed as an attack on the survival of the white race. And I exaggerate not.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's in a lot of ways true what you're saying. You know, we're dealing with, I think, a lot of historic failures here. You know, one thing I point out to people, that if you go back you know, we have this thing about like, oh, you know, white working class men, they're kind of like irredeemably a reactionary, right wing, racist. And you see that is the bastion of support for the Republican Party, white men without a college degree. Yet, if you look at the 2012 election, you know, it's something like about 25% of white men who are working class and not in unions voted for Obama. So, like, over 70% voted for Romney. But if they were in a union, it was reverse. It was something like then 75% of white working class men voted for Obama over Romney, which is just an astonishing, you know, was a 50-point difference. It was an astonishing difference. So it's not that they can't be, their attitudes can't be changed.
Oh, I quite agree. But I think what I'm describing is something similar to birds in a murmuration who check each other's movement and move
right
according to, I mean, it's a good survival pattern for them, and I think that's happening right now in the Midwest, and it's very strong.
Yeah, and you know, just to bring in quickly, you know, what we see going on with the GM strike, where the contract that the UAW agreed to is pretty much terrible. And this is the failure of the national union leadership in a lot of ways. They still are mired in this, essentially. They're still fossils, basically. They are trying to force down a terrible contract down the union members' throats, where they don't deal with the primary issues behind the strike, which is the tiered wage system that resulted after the Great Recession that the Obama administration forced on the auto workers, or the growing use of temporary workers by GM to pay them much lower wages, you know, like $15 an hour or even less, compared to the $31 an hour that workers who have been working in the industry since before 2008 can top out at. And so a number of locals have rejected the contract. And so, you know, we have this kind of like failure of you know, left liberal labor institutions that I think has created this situation where you have such a reactionary element. And what Trump has very successfully done is to basically play the politics of right-wing grievances, but especially to like bind his base to him, where they believe that his suffering is equivalent to their suffering, right? And the reality is, you know, we have to be aware that there is a tremendous amount of suffering out there. You know, certainly, though, you know, when you look at people who are meet the definition of poor, working poor, they are still more likely to vote Democrat than Republican. But something like, you know, even close to 50% of white working poor are voting for Trump. And so,
so these are the facts on the ground.
Yeah.
So what I really look forward to asking you is, what are the salient points of the impeachment process as they move forward now, and what effect do you think it will have? Will there be any good effect?
Well, you know, it's really hard to game out. And when this started a month ago, I said basically, don't trust anyone who tells you they know what's going to happen, or don't trust those people who are saying, like, you know, again, you heard all these leftists. I call many of them the Trump and left. You know, there's this just really appalling tendency to try and defend the worst of Trump because he's sticking his thumb in the eye of bourgeois norms and civilities. Never mind, this is a guy running concentration camps, killing brown people. But You know, it could backfire. No one knows that. But like I said, there simply was no choice. Not to impeach him would have said, you can do whatever you want to steal the election, and the Supreme Court will just ratify it. You know, they already basically stole one election, and that was in 2000 with between Bush and Gore. And that was with a significantly less reactionary and ideological.
And that's been successfully forgotten, I think you can
yeah,
say.
Yeah, and that was, you know, less ideological Supreme Court. What's interesting to me is how this is one of these moments where, you know, weeks and months and even years of history compress into a short period. And so we have seen a significant shift in public attitude. Now we're at something like a solid majority. The latest polls are showing above 50%, as high as 55% of people support impeachment.
Impeachment and removal, or just impeachment?
Just impeachment, but I think it is just about a majority support a removal. And of course, the Republicans are just completely off their rocker, you know, acting like dime store brown shirts trying to break up a meeting, you know, the way that Patriot Prayer does and has tried that tactic.
Are you talking about the recent incident in which they all came in with their cell phones at a hearing?
At the secure...
That's bizarre. You can read about that at commondreams.org.
Yeah, yeah. All over the news yesterday. So... you know, they don't basically have any sort of argument. So he definitely has been damaged thus far. But, you know, a year is a hell of a long time, especially with this president, you know, who remembers stuff that even happened a few weeks ago, right? Do we recall, like, how many hundreds and hundreds of people died in the Bahamas, and then the U.S. Cruelly prevented survivors from coming to the U.S.
Knowing that they did not have the infrastructure to sustain the survivors, that they do not have that.
Right, right. Or that, you know, their Trump administration is in the process right now of trying to force something like 50,000 Haitians back to Haiti, a country that is in open revolt right now against the government, which Trump backs, because they've signed on to their anti-Venezuela front. And, you know, this is one of the revolts that we're seeing, uprisings that we're seeing just all over the world right now. You know, the media are focusing on Hong Kong. That is a very newsworthy story. But we're seeing that these protests have broken out in places like Ecuador, Chile, of course, Lebanon, Iraq, Catalan. There was the Gilets Jaunes earlier, late last year and earlier this year in France, the uprising in Puerto Rico that forced the governor from office, you know, Egypt and Iraq, you know, just and also just really... mass slaughter going on. Something like, you know, 150 protesters have been killed in Iraq. Chile reports are coming out of dozens of protesters killed in Haiti. Dozens have been killed. There was one incident a year ago in November 2018 where anywhere from 70 to 300 people were killed in one town because these were supporters from the party FANMI Lavalas of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was, you know, the radical priest who was the champion of the poor, who the U.S. Basically deposed twice, once in the 90s and again in 2004. And so, you know, we're seeing just this incredible upsurge around the world. And speaking of the media, there's almost no news. You know, there is a little news here and there, but it's certainly not being put into context
going on. I've heard a lot more about pumpkin spice than about this. We do have a caller. Would you like to take calls?
Sure.
Okay. We'll go to the first call. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Hello. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Mr. Gupta. I'm currently reading a terrific book called On the Clock by Emily Gundelsberger. It's what low-wage work did to me and how it drives America insane.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for a title? So I'm so happy to get on the phone with you. Life expectancy in our country has gone down 3 years in a row. It's incredible how many premature deaths you have in order for your life expectancy to drop like that. Prison populations are through the roof. Suicide is through the roof. The number of people on antidepressants is through the roof. What do you say to folks who say, by not talking about the issues, you know, socialized medicine, a living wage, getting out of all these imperialist wars, what do you say to folks that say you're actually helping Trump by talking about impeachment rather than these issues that are killing people, literally? Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think setting that up is, you know, a false binary, that one comes at the expense of the other.
I think it's called whataboutism.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, it's also like, look, you know, of course, we can be having those discussions, and this is not the fault of, you know, anyone who's politically active to saying, like, yes, he needs to be impeached, otherwise he's going to nakedly steal the election, right? That's what this keeps coming back to. I think if there's any criticism, it's just I've watched all the Democratic debates, and it's absolutely appalling how every debate they are immediately going after Bernie and Warren over this issue of, you know, do you want, you're going to raise taxes on the middle class to pay for Medicare for all, which is just such absurd right-wing framing, right? This is Republican talking points. Why don't they ever ask the other candidates, why do you think it's okay for people to die? From lack of medical care, from tens of thousands of people to die from affordable medical care every year. Why do you think, how do you justify hundreds of thousands of people going bankrupt for medical bills, people who have insurance, right? You got to remember, medical bankruptcy, I think, affects of those, the estimated 500,000, and that is an accurate number, who go into medical bankruptcy every year, 80% of them do have insurance, right? Having insurance does nothing to prevent you from going into bankruptcy. Why is that okay that we have 500,000 people and households go into bankruptcy every year? And, you know, it's just like, yeah, as far as imperialist wars, of course, yes. You know, the U.S. is an imperialist state, has a lot of neocolonial practices, but that's has nothing to do with the impeachment inquiry. It's just like it keeps coming back to that. Maybe there are good arguments against impeachment. I think there's plenty of reasons to be cautious about it, and it's an unknown what ultimately the effect is going to be. Remember, you know, in October 2016, everyone thought Trump was toast, even the Republican Party, after the Access Hollywood tape where he said, you know, grab them by the blank. So, and yet he won just weeks later. This is all highly unpredictable. But if the Democrats had not done anything, he was trying to rig the election. And once it came to light, if they didn't do anything, what they're saying to him is, go ahead and rig the election. It could be ballot box stuffing. It could be electronic theft, all sorts of stuff. We know that they're going to engage in all sorts of...
Poll closure was big and effective.
Yeah. So,
poll closures in Detroit.
You know, in Georgia, the way that the gubernatorial election was stolen from Stacey Abrams. So, you know, it's, I think, or not, I don't think, it's clear there was no other recourse. And I think it is, you know, in many ways, the media is doing a poor job in general, right? You know, why aren't they covering the fact that there are these revolts in all these countries? You know, they're spending plenty of time in Hong Kong. Well, part of the reason, I think a big part of the reason, is because these revolts are happening in countries that the U.S. Backs, or where the U.S. has had a history of coups and wars, you know.
Which brings me back to Chilenos, and they must surely be looking at what's happening with the Trump administration, and given the history in 73 with Kissinger and Nixon and their aide to the Pinochet faction, which went on for quite a while and effectively covered up their tortures and disappearances. And you have to wonder if tortures and disappearances are definitely happening right now, and you have to wonder if people are being tortured in Chile.
Oh, no. There are plenty of reports coming out of people who are being tortured, of people being disappeared. The president is a billionaire, and, you know, the reporting, I think, is really shoddy in a lot of ways because it usually starts out with this, like, oh, how could this be happening in Chile? It's the most prosperous country in Latin America, you know. Never mind the fact that the minimum wage is $400 a month, that pensions are $200 a month, that, you know, and what we see in a lot of countries is, you know, poor basic services and expensive basic services. Chile was set off by transportation, a fare hike, and it has some of the most expensive mass transit in the world, and they were going to hike it even more, and that led to a student-led campaign to evade the fares. Police started arresting and brutalizing fare evaders, and that's what set off these protests. You know, the individual reasons really vary from country to country, obviously. You know, in Lebanon, it was a tax on WhatsApp, but there, which is, you know, outside the U.S., WhatsApp is a very commonly used messaging service. Often it's the preferred communication service, and WhatsApp is owned by our good friend Mark Zuckerberg over at Facebook, who's doing his best to destroy what exists of formal democracy across the world, because that's good for Facebook. You know, in France, it was actually gasoline taxes that set off the yellow vest movement. But again, there, what you're dealing with is, you know, like, France does have more of like a social welfare system, but that has been under assault.
It's that last. I mean, the thing I see in common is just that last straw. People have been crushed enough, and their wages have kept going down, according to what would please the Chicago School of Economics, actually.
Right, the Chicago boys, Milton Friedman, who were notorious for, you know, Chile is the original neoliberal model under Pinochet.
We have time for one last call. Lynn's on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'll make it quick. Just while we're talking about fighting neoliberalism, remind everybody that there's still a boycott of Burgerville going on.
Okay.
And they declared they are on strike as of this week at 4 stops. And I would invite anybody to come to their big pickets on Saturday.
Where would that be?
It's going to be at the Montevilla Burgerville at 82nd and Gleason, I think it is. The best way to keep up on it, on their events, is to check their Facebook page.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So I'll let Arun wrap up now. Do you have any final thoughts about Chile impeachment?
Yeah, well, you know, let's, you know, just turn to the U.S. You know, we are seeing the largest upsurge in strike activity in over 30 years. You know, definitely support those Burgerville workers. I covered that campaign. A local journalist who's been doing good work on it, Shane Burley, has been covering the Burgerville workers as well. Really just a great organizing campaign and model. And, you know, it's not a surprise that they've been fighting the workers for something like 16 months, refusing to agree to their reasonable demands. But, you know, Chicago teachers are on a strike right now. There's other industrial workers who are on strike, teachers in Los Angeles. You know, they had a huge strike earlier this year. So, you know, we are seeing like a little bit of an upsurge that is happening around the world as well. And, you know, a lot of it is obviously about daily life, but it is, let's also, you know, let's not just reduce it to wages. It is about corruption. It is about the lack of meaningful democracy in any way, shape, and form. And I think a lot of it also has to do, you know, with the terrible job that the media are doing in so many ways, as well as, you know, the result of the gutting of media.
Which brings us around to KBOO, your people-supported radio station. And I urge you to bring up KBOO.fm now and tag us for a little bit of money. I would like to thank you, Arun, for taking time out of your day to come in. Arun Gupta, internationally known journalist. And I want you to stay tuned for more of the Radio Zine on your people-supported radio station, KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.fm to all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Coming up next on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein continues the series on Julian Assange, Countdown to Freedom. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with writer Miriam Tevez. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake shares her singular takes on politics, parenting, and pop culture with your host, S.W. Conser. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Latin American Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. The next film in the series, Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, is showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. Dia de los Muertos follows Salma, a 16-year-old orphan who has never met her biological parents. Salma has spent most of her life searching out clues for her parents' identity. One day, she discovers a specific book and sets off on an adventure with her foster brothers to find the missing links to her family's heritage. Again, that's Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of